Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
Hey, everybody. Welcome in. It's David Summers hosting another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. This is the story of wrestling in America, as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So now, let's step back into the ring, back into time, as we get wall-to-wall and tree-top tall with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Hey, Ron, last week's Studcast was another big one, absolutely. Listened to by thousands and thousands. I have seen all kinds of comments from fans of the show about your grandfather. Roy has become quite popular with your listeners. I think he may be fast becoming an American folklore character. I guess that's a good way to describe it. I wonder what it would be like if Roy were handling things today.
Oh, I don't know. It'd be a lot different, I'd say that.
I bet.
Especially what goes on in the ring.
No doubt. Yeah,
that's a polite way of putting it, man, calling him a folklore character. You might not, there's a lot of men out there who wouldn't use those exact words about him, I think. So, you know, I've got to realize over the last 6 years while doing these studcasts just how unknown my wrestling family is in the history of the sport, and especially the fans that are not from the southern United States. So, you know, the Welches, you know, we don't get much credit for many things that we were the first to do in the sport. The first generation, for instance, Roy and his three brothers, they basically introduced tag matches to the South in the southern United States. They had the first ever six-man tag match because my grandfather obviously had the two older brothers, Herb and Jack, and both of those guys were taught to wrestle pretty quickly after Roy was. And obviously they started, you know, it was kind of a no-brainer to turn a tag match with four guys into a six-man because you had the three Welch brothers. So, you know, that Roy was like a kind of a creator in all types of different ways, man. So, you know, my father, you know, better known as Buddy Fuller, he's in the second generation of the Welch family. He was the first to build wrestling rings that were made of all steel. You know, up at that to that point, they were just made out of wood, man. 2x4s and plywood and, you know, the ring posts were wood. I mean, so, you know, Dad kind of just changed everything so far as the rings were concerned. And, you know, he was the first to give away cars in tournaments. He was the first to take advertising of the sport to basically an all new level, man. First wrestling promoter to buy signs on taxi cabs and city buses and city benches. That had never been done before. He was the first to pass out discount tickets to business owners that allowed him to, you know, to put those famous wrestling posters that you see in such demand today. People will want these wrestling posters from the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, the 60s, you know. So Dad handed out these discount tickets to people that own these companies and own these businesses that let him put those posters in the window. And then the owners could use those tickets for themselves, or they could give them to their customers as gifts. So, you know, my dad even created that really famous logo back in that time called Wrestling the King of Sports. And, you know, he put it on all of his advertising. So, you know, my generation, you know, we even did a few things, man, that had never been done. We had mink coat tournaments, which had never been done before. We had these outside wrestling concert events in the summertime. We've had wrestling rings in the water. And we were first to buy the, you know, freeway billboards. I was the first one to do that. You know, the other companies bought billboards, but they never bought the freeway billboards. And we actually introduced Southern Street Fights. So, you know, that's kind of one reason I've been doing these studcasts every week for years, Dave. You know, fans should know, not only are we the biggest family in the sports history, we're also one of the most creative as well.
Well, to me, innovation, that's what moved this sport forward. Your grandfather, certainly, your father, absolutely, and then there you were, quite the innovator yourself. All of this is so amazing to me, Stud. You've never brought up most of this before. Some of this I think I've heard about. Your family legacy is so much more than just a lot of wrestlers trying to make a name for themselves. It's about time someone acknowledged your family, in my opinion. Speaking of making a name for himself, are we still going to hear about your grandfather's wrestling bear today? I think you mentioned that last week. I've been waiting for this. Let's hear it.
Oh, well, man, we sure are, Dave. You know, and this is another first for the family, too. Roy actually had the first wrestling bear, and we're also going to talk about what happened on the first day of April in 1980 in this studcast in Mobile, Alabama's Expo Hall. Had a very unusual 8-man tag match with 8 stars of the sport in the ring at the same time. Plus, we're going to do today's card. It has a United States Junior Heavyweight title match on it and 4 opening matches. 18 men on the card, man. One of those 18 wrestlers, too, was a famous one that was returning, coming back to the Gulf Coast again for his first run in Southeastern, but he had been to the Gulf Coast before. And he was an old-time bad boy in that part of the country, and we'll be getting into that today as well.
All right, cool deal. So I usually never tell you what our learning tree questions are until we make sure that we have time for it, but I think we can squeeze it in today, and we have a very interesting one if we do. That ask about the 4 NWA world champions during the 1970s. Did you wrestle them all? And which did you prefer to wrestle?
Well, Jace, man, that sounds like an interesting one. I hope we get to that. So, you know, I'm ready to ride, man. And I'm looking forward, Dave, to telling the story of Ginger, man. And with my grandfather's famous bear, man, who after, you know, extensive research, I found that quite possibly Ginger might have been the first professional wrestling bear ever. So to me, Dave, this is one of the best wrestling stories ever told, and this will be my first time to do so, to tell this particular story. So let's go back, man, to how it started with Roy and his bear. In the strangest of all ways, man, in the mid-1930s, Roy happened to be coming back from a night in West Virginia. And he had to leave home later in the day, and he had to make the trip alone, which he didn't normally do. He would normally take the guys that were going to be wrestling with him, but they had to go ahead of him. So he had to make this trip alone, 1,200-mile round trip from Dyersburg, Tennessee, into West Virginia. Mm-hmm. So Roy takes this trip, and on his way home, on a deserted stretch of 2-lane road, which all roads were 2-lane roads back in the 1930s. He's right in the Blue Ridge Mountains of West Virginia, and he came upon a dead mama bear, man, laying on the side of the road. She'd been hit by a car. And then she had a cub that was in the middle of the road when Roy first saw him. Lights came up, caught the bear, the little cub still there. So the cub obviously wasn't going to leave his mother, you know, and he stood no chance, you know, and he stood a really good chance, basically, of being hit by, maybe by a car itself, you know, while he's staying there by his mom right there on the side of the road. So Roy told me he was afraid for the little cub's life, and he didn't feel good about leaving it there. So he picked her up, and he put her in the trunk of his car, and he brought her home. So 600 miles later, back in Dyersburg, Tennessee, just miles from the Mississippi River, he couldn't decide basically what am I going to do with this little bear. So while trying to figure that out, he began to feed her, and he had just started his dairy, and he had cows there, and he fed this little bear with a baby bottle, cow's milk from a baby bottle. And he told me in a way, you know, he kind of became an instant substitute for the bear's mama, you know. Yep. I mean, so as time went by, you know, he kept the little bear, and he kept feeding her, and then he trained her as if she was a dog. He told me he trained her how to let him know when she needed to go to the bathroom. He would let her outside, and then end up fixing her a room inside his house. And so Roy and his bear, they grew very close together really fast. So over the next 2 years, he said she became too big to live in the house, and he moved her outside. And she had become more dangerous around other people. Hmm. But he said she was totally respectful of him. I mean, she, you know, he meant everything to her. He was like her mother in a way.
Yeah, he was the daddy and the mama, no doubt. All right, so where did the idea come from to teach Ginger to wrestle?
Well, I asked that question, obviously, and Roy said there was a wrestling ring in the barn on his property. And we mentioned Charlie Carr, and I think the last episode, one of the guys that came with Roy from Ohio into Tennessee, and they trained, Roy had trained him, and along with Pat Malone, Charlie Carr, and then Charlie Carr became a trainer for Roy in the state of Tennessee. So Charlie Carr, he said that there was a barn there, and that's where Charlie Carr used to train his wrestlers. Roy said, you know, when they weren't using the ring in the barn, he said he'd take Ginger out there and he'd kind of play with her in the ring. So he said, you know, he soon realized, he said that she had a little natural wrestling instinct, you know, and he said, you know, once he realized that, he popped into his head. He said, I thought if a bear could be taught to wrestle, uh-huh, and if wrestlers would get in the ring with him and wrestled him, how popular would that be, right? You know, and then he said, after thinking about it, he says, I thought it might be the most significant event in the history of the sport. So he began to teach Ginger actual wrestling moves, like standing on her feet and locking up with him, just like wrestlers did when they started a match. He taught her how to give a wrestler a flying mare, which was a hold that, wrestlers used all the time back in those days. And he got her to be sitting and taught her how to sit up straight and on her rear end. And then he would switch around behind her. He'd stick his head out over her shoulder, and she'd reach up with that front right paw and wrap it around his head real tight and fall forward and send him flying across the mat in front of her, right? She'd learned a wrestling move, a bear, right? So then he said, well, you know, maybe I can teach her something else. So he taught her how to do a monkey flip. And in order to make that happen, he would have her standing on her hind legs in the middle of the ring, and he'd run away from her, hit the ropes, and come off and charge her. When he ran into her, he taught her to fall on her back and use her back feet to catch him in the stomach and flip him high over her head and onto the mat behind her, man. So he said, they're doing some things here that, who would have thought that a bear could do that?
Wow, that is really amazing. And really, while you were talking about that, I was thinking about, well, you think about the bear cubs, or think about dogs or cats when they're very small. They fight and wrestle constantly. To me, that's really cool, and the bear cubs have to do the same. So some of that really is instinct and natural, but your grandfather teaching these moves, that is amazing. She could actually do real wrestling moves? I mean, wow.
Absolutely, and more than what I just described. Other moves as well, you know. So old-time wrestlers that saw her wrestle told me, they said, Ron, she was the best wrestling bear we ever saw, you know, and a lot of bears came along after Roy's bear for the reason that it became hugely popular, man. Wrestling bears became the big deal. But Roy's was the first, and those old timers like Pat Malone and the original guys that came out of Ohio and went with Roy said that Ginger was the greatest wrestling bear they ever saw. So one of the best things he did with her, though, was at the end of each one of these matches that she would have, he'd have someone hand him a Coca-Cola, and she would sit up on her rear end and she'd drink it down just like a person would. It was like the highlight of every match, Roy said, and actually she became famous for it. And if you think about it, you know, when you train an animal, you have to reward them constantly with something they really like. And so he began doing this, I'm sure, from the first time he ever worked out with her. You know, at the end of his workout and he finished with her, he gave her the Coke. And he taught her how to sit up and how to highlight what she was doing, the drinking of it. Mm-hmm. And that became one of the greatest and the most important parts of her matches.
Well, you said earlier that she was kind of dangerous with anyone but Roy. Did she ever seriously hurt anybody?
Well, only once that I'm aware of, and that person that she hurt was my father. And so Roy would sometimes take her and stake her out in the backyard of their house, you know, put her on a long chain and give her some room and gave her outside and get her out of the cage. And, you know, it left her, it was a really good exercise thing for her and a great way for him to give her a little running room and let her get out and do her own thing. So she could get some exercise. And my father was about 12 years old. And, you know, it didn't take long for everybody in the neighborhood and all his friends to find out that he had a bear that lived at his house, right? Not everybody has a bear at their house. And one day a bunch of his friends came over and she happened to be staked out. And Roy was home that day but working on something on the far side of the house, Dad said. And then Dad was kind of showing off a little bit. He wanted to show off for his friends. He wanted them to see how she did the Coca-Cola deal. So he got, but when he started looking for a Coke, he couldn't find a Coke, a bottle that was full of Coke, you know? So he filled up a Coke bottle with water and he took it over to where she was staked out. And he thought she was at the end of her chain. But, when he reached out and he put the Coke bottle down there, she grabbed it and she set up, and as soon as the first bit of liquid hit her mouth and she realized it wasn't Coke, she was pretty upset. And when she realized it wasn't Coke, she dropped that bottle and she lunged out at Dad, and he was a little too close to her, man. He thought she was at the end of the chain, but she wasn't. So she got one front paw behind his shoe and she tripped him. He fell backwards.
Wow.
And then she reached out with her big paw, man, and she had her claws. She had her claws and teeth, you know. So she buried those claws, he said, into his right thigh, and she drug him under her, man, and she went for his stomach with her teeth. She was going to end it for him, man. And Dad screamed, and so did obviously all these buddies of his. They're seeing the bear's got him now, right? So Dad saved his own life. He said when he saw her open her mouth and she saw that she was going to go for his stomach, she put his hands in her mouth.
Ooh.
So that she couldn't really get a bite of anything but just the back of his hands and fingers. And it kind of prevented her basically from ripping him wide open right there, man, and ending it. And so he then tried to crawl backwards and he about to get away, but she buried her claws in him again and drug him back under her again. So she, the second time, she bit him on the right thigh. He's 12 years old, man. This has got to be a really horrible sight and a horrible experience, because he said when she bit him on the right thigh, she tore the skin loose and she pulled his thigh muscle, came out of his leg, and she bit it in two, and it snapped. And when it snapped, he said he kind of passed out at that point. He wasn't able to do anything. Well, luckily, Roy heard all this screaming, right? Mm-hmm. He was able to come running around the house, and as soon as he got to where she could hear him, he just screamed at her, and she knew this wasn't something he was going to like, and she ran away from Dad and left him there, you know. And if he hadn't have been there that day, Dave, there would have been no Buddy Fuller, and there would have certainly been no Ron and Robert.
Wow. Wow. I mean, what a terrible thing for a 12-year-old boy to experience. So how did your father recover from that? How long did that take?
Well, Dad was a fighter, man, you know, and it couldn't have bothered him too bad, because in the long run, about 12 years later, he and his uncle Lester were going to be training Ginger's only offspring after World War II. So he's going to be training the bear later on, you know, but, all his life, he had these scars on his legs, and no telling how many times people ask him, what happened to your legs? And, you know,
wow.
So he had a heck of a story to tell, that's for sure.
I mean, after almost being killed by a bear, he trained one years later. That's saying a lot about being tough. So when did Ginger start wrestling professionally?
Well, I'm not sure about the actual date, but I do know that just recently the fan sent me an article from the sports page in Nashville, Tennessee, in 1940. It had the date on the article, and that Ginger was on a card in 1940. So she had to be trained in wrestling before that, you know, and I'm sure Roy spent 2 or 3 years, no doubt, working with her before he ever felt comfortable to put her into the ring. So she was in the ring probably, I'm going to guess, maybe 1937, 1938. And on this same card, in this article from a Nashville newspaper, it was Roy and his brother Herb was wrestling in the first ever tag team match in Tennessee history on this same card that the article gave. So it kind of gave me an idea that she had to been trained. Roy probably found her in maybe 1934 and, didn't start training her for a couple of years, maybe even a few more. And then he trained her for about 3 years. So she probably started wrestling, I'm going to say somewhere around probably 1938, 39. By 40, she was definitely wrestling. So, and also know, Dave, the Ginger was one of the greatest drawing attractions in wrestling history. Roy told me that on any card she was ever on, he said they never failed to sell out. And he said that often, you know, they would turn away hundreds and sometimes thousands of people when they were in a big city that couldn't get in, that heard that the bear was going to be wrestling the man. It was a huge deal. It was something that was a monstrous deal, and it became big time.
Well, what other entertainment was there? I mean, when somebody hears a wrestling bear, well, they got to be able to say, yep, I saw it. So that is so cool. This is really a great start to a studcast, Ron.
Well, yeah, Dave, and there's a little bit more to this, man. So, you know, she wasn't finished, man, Ginger, by a long run, man. So about 1941, when World War II started, Americans, I mean, they had the Pearl Harbor in December of 41. So that changed everything for professional wrestling. The war, you know, everybody's focused. They're gone. They're fighting overseas. And, the men are mostly gone. And you had the women that were starting to take the place of the men in the factories and elsewhere, you know. So it was a really tough time to be in the wrestling business. So Roy was, at this point in 1941, he was 40 years old. And he was considered at that point too old to go and fight, at 41. So he said the war reminded him of the Great Depression days that we talked about last week, I think, in that episode about how horrible a time it was, and how almost all sports in America shut down. It wasn't just professional wrestling. I mean, baseball, football, it was a tough time, a real different time frame, but Roy didn't shut down, so he decided to close his wrestling company down. Didn't really have any choice. He wasn't going to be able to draw big crowds, and he decided he was going to take Ginger on a 3-year tour. He was going to take her on a tour of North America from 1942 until 1945. Roy traveled with Ginger, and he went. He had a special trailer made for her, and he hooked it on the back of his car, and he took her off across America, and the first country went into was Mexico. And he said even though there were few men to promote to before they left the country, they're still in America as he went down to Mexico. And he said they wrestled some events in America. And he said because this was such a unique event, he said the ladies couldn't even resist, that women would come and watch. They wanted to see the bear, they wanted to see this, right? So he said even when he was in America before he got to Mexico, who was not involved in the World War, he said that, they saw she was selling out everywhere. So when he crossed into Mexico, he said she was a bigger attraction to Mexico than she was in America. The people were amazed, they said it was unreal. So he worked the entire country of Mexico from the border all the way to the southern tip and all the way up the western coast. And he says then he came back into the U.S. He worked all the way up the coast from California, Oregon, Washington, on into Canada. Then he took her all the way across Canada to the Atlantic Ocean.
Wow.
And he said for 3 years, every show, everywhere they went was a sellout.
Wow. Okay, a couple of things. Who wrestled her every night? And what happened to Ginger after all this?
Well, Roy said he wrestled her every time because, he said that he didn't want to take any chances that she might hurt somebody. Mm-hmm. For one thing, she was familiar with him and she knew how to, what to expect from him, but he didn't, and he said and he didn't want somebody to maybe possibly hurt her. He had some goofballs, right, in the wrestling business that might have thought, well, I might can beat this bear. so then he said he got back home in 1945 and he found a zoo that would take her, obviously she's a pretty tame bear by most bear standards, so I'm sure she was really great for a zoo, and he said, but he said, I made an arrangement with the zoo. He said that if she ever had a cub, that after she raised the cub to where he's a couple of years old, that I got the cub. So he had basically finally retired, and soon she had a cub of her own. And when that cub was pretty much fully grown, he was handed over to Roy. And Roy gave the cub to his younger brother, Lester, and my dad, who were only 1 year apart in age. Lester was about 20 years younger than his brother, Roy. Mm-hmm. And so he gave Lester, who was training to wrestle, and Dad was training to wrestle at that point, he gave those two guys the bear. And so together they trained him. And Ginger's son, I don't know what that bear was called. I couldn't find out the name of that bear. And then Roy and nobody ever told me. But Lester in 1949, 4 years after the war was over, he took that her son, that bear, on a 2-year tour to some of the same cities that Roy and Ginger had visited years earlier in Canada and Mexico. So just one more thing, Dave, I'd like to say on Roy's behalf, there were many bears trained by to wrestle after Ginger, but she was the only one ever trained that did not have any of her teeth pulled or any of her claws removed before she was trained. And afterward, and that's only because Roy and her were so familiar with one another, he could put this muzzle on her every time that she wrestled. He could put the mittens on her for her claws. If you couldn't do that, then other people that trained bears, they pulled their canine teeth and they removed all their claws.
Yeah.
What a horrible experience that had to be for a bear. So Ginger never had that done to her. And I think it was a perfect example of how much love there was between Roy and his bear.
Yeah, and matter of fact, and I know Roy knew this, but that bear was a dangerous bear, except for the fact that that bear thought Roy was the mama. So, I mean, that's amazing. Your grandfather was a one-of-a-kind human being. They don't make them like that anymore at all. Wow.
Wow. So, before we leave this subject, too, I'd like to say something about my grandmother.
Okay.
And she deserves this. A lot of credit for having the patience to deal with a man like Roy to begin with. I mean, Roy was he was far out there. And so, and during the years now, when Roy and Ginger made this tour, 1942 to 1945, he left my grandmother living on this. They had a small dairy farm at this point that they had just started together in the little town called Yorkville, Tennessee. On the western side of the state of Tennessee. So when Roy returned after the tour, he started spending half of his week every week in Nashville, because that's where he set up his wrestling office. And he'd spend the other half at the dairy farm. So while all this was going on, man, and she was there every day in charge of running the dairy. And that small dairy, man, from the late 40s, by the time they got into the 1960s, that dairy grew from, I remember the first time that I ever went into their milk barn, they could only put about 10 cows in the barn, and I think they probably only had 30 cows. By 1960, Dave, they milked 1,000 cows a day.
That is quite an operation. I can't believe that. I'm still amazed how tough she was in the story you told about how she came in from the fields plowing with mules to give birth to your father and went back to the field the same day. The same day. So you come from some very tough folk, Ron, no doubt about it. What a great way to begin this studcast. Hey, we're going to take our break right here. Let's do that. And when we return, let's go to Mobile, Alabama. Let's bring it back to April 1st, 1980, because I think you got a tremendous card there. The TV to promote it, the results of the matches, and the attendances. We're going to get that done when we come back on this Studcast. Hey, Studcast fans, get ready. The next Ask the Stud number 16 is going to be released Saturday, April 20th, 2024. If you would like to ask a question for the show on Facebook, please leave it on the Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud Facebook site in the post that is there now. If you're on X or Twitter, please leave it on the Ron Fuller Welch page in the post that is there now. Thanks for your participation. The show will be on YouTube Southeastern Rewind Saturday, April 20th, 2024. And thanks for your support. All right, Studcast fans, welcome back. Another incredible Studcast with the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller. I'm David Summers. Thanks for hanging out with us. And this one is called, this is episode number 344, right, Ron?
Right.
344. All right. It's called Wild 8-Man Tag and Ginger First Wrestling Bear. which we got an incredible hidden history lesson on earlier. All right, so let's go to Mobile, Alabama, and let's check out the card for April 1st, 1980, Expo Hall. What you got, Ron?
Well, in terms of number of wrestlers, man, this is going to be the biggest card so far in Southeastern Gulf Coast history. So the opening match on this one was going to be Eddie Boulder versus Big Bill Dromo. Local favorite, Ricky Fields, son of Lee Fields, was going to be taking on Randy Rose. Roy Lee Welch was facing the big Texan, man, the guy that I mentioned that in the earlier part of this studcast, there was a big star there in this, in the Gulf Coast before Southeastern came. Big Ron Bass was coming back into the Gulf Coast. It's going to be his first run for me in Southeastern. Charlie Cook and Don Fargo were returning against each other in a special 30-minute time limit match. They had a match the week before. It was a 15-minute time limit, and the time ran out. So this one is going to be a 30-minute one. And then in the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship match, Norvell Austin was going to get his first shot in 4 months at Tony Charles' belt. And he'd earned that shot by beating Tony Charles the week before. So then the main event for this card was an 8-man tag team match. It was the Georgia Jawjacker, Joe LeDuc, Robert Fuller, and myself facing off against the Mongolian Stomper, Jimmy Golden, the Big C, and Dr. Bill Irwin, managed by Don Carson.
All right. That's a tremendous card. An 8-man tag, a U.S. junior title match, and Ron Bass returning with 18 wrestlers in all. So with all those wrestlers, it must have been a great TV show. So who and what was on that TV to set all this up?
Well, I'm going to get to the TV show in a couple of minutes, but there was something very concerning going on during this time frame. Jimmy Golden had been having back problems for a while. And we all had been encouraging him to hang in there. Back problems usually got better when you were a wrestler, and all wrestlers had back problems at one time or another. So the back was basically probably the most important part of the body for a wrestler. And when it got really bad, as much as you might want to, sometimes it got to where you just couldn't go anymore. So it meant that some guys, if they didn't take off for a long period of time to get their back well, they could injure themselves so badly that they could actually end their career. It'd be over. Jimmy's a young guy at this point, way too young for that to happen to him. So everyone in the crew was concerned, especially the five owners of the company, of which Jimmy was one of those owners. So luckily, he was involved in this 8-man tag angle that we're having here. This card had an 8-man tag main event, and that meant he had three partners, so he wasn't going to have to spend a lot of time in the ring, and hopefully he wasn't going to risk any further injury on his back. It was still a concern to all of us, especially Jimmy, because Jimmy didn't know anything else but wrestling. That was his whole life, and it was the only thing he knew to make a living. So at the same time, Joe LeDuc had already told Rob and I that he was going to Japan at the middle of the month of April. So we're talking about just, a couple of weeks down the road from where we are in this studcast. So Joe LeDuc is going to be gone. And after that, he said he wanted to go home to Canada, and he wanted to stay in Canada for at least a month or so, and he said it'd probably be 8 or 10 weeks before he came back, maybe June of 1980 before he returned.
Wow, so both of those things at the same time had to be bad news. That was two top wrestlers, and if Jimmy couldn't keep going, only one of the two was going to be returning as bookers. So how do you handle something like that?
Well, it's very difficult, my man. At least we had some notice in advance, but even that, in some cases didn't help. If we couldn't find a good replacement and fast, basically, in case Jimmy might never return, so it was just a part of booking, man, a wrestling territory. And it certainly wasn't our first rodeo, Rob and I. You know, we'd been doing this for a while now. So, you know, we just put our heads to it and we try to make the best of it. So let's go back to the TV. So this TV show, like the card we just talked about, was loaded with wrestlers. And we had plenty of guys in tag matches, multiple guys in a tag match like that. Putting them into an eight-man tag made it difficult to do TVs and house shows because you had to add wrestlers to the cards in order to have enough matches. So every once in a while, you needed to do something different to keep your business going. And we were doing big booming business at this point. So, we didn't want to just keep sticking with the same cards and the same guys. So we went to this eight-man tag thing for a bit here. So lots of bookers didn't figure out things like that, man, until it was too late for them. You know, all of a sudden they go from selling out to half a house and they're wondering what went wrong, you know. So we kind of got ahead of the game here and it helped us. So this TV opened with the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion, Tony Charles, at the set with Charlie Platt. And he had the belt with him. Basically, he set it down on the front of the desk in front of him. And they watched a very unusual loss for Tony against Norvell Austin from the week before. And it was a loss that Norvell had predicted on the last TV show that we talked about last week. And it appeared that Charles was not quite as confident of a win as he had been last week when he promised Norvell that I'll give you a shot at the belt if you can beat me. So Norvell got it done. So everyone had just watched the result of that match on the video.
All right, so how about the first TV match? Who was in that?
Well, the man had just beaten Charles 4 days earlier, Norvell. You know, and his opponent was already in the ring and had been announced. And when Norvell came out of the dressing room, which was right there by the ring in those small studios back in that day, instead of him getting in the ring, he went straight to the set where Tony Charles was. And he asked, Charlie Platt and all the idiots out there in the studios and that dummies at home, were they surprised to see that video? Were they surprised to see that Tony Charles can be beat? And he said, I beat him. Everybody saw me beat him. And now he's got to defend the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship belt. He says it's my chance to get my title back. Actually, he had been the only guy to beat Tony for that belt since Tony came there in 1978. And he beat him about 4 months earlier. And, he told Tony Charles basically right there, he says, I'm going to do it again. So then he reached for the belt that was sitting on the front of the desk. And Tony popped up, man, out of his seat, and he snatched his belt before Austin got his hands on it. And he made a little move toward Norvell, and Norvell backed away kind of slowly. But he was still running his mouth, and he said, you better sleep with that belt before next week, he said, because I'm going to be wearing it after that. So he rolled up in the ring. He was laughing at Charles at this point. And soon after he got his introduction and the bell rang, he left his opponent laying, man, and beat him with another one of those diving headbutts.
Wow. Which were amazing to me. It sounded like Norvell was extremely confident he was going to be the next United States Junior Heavyweight Champion. All right, so who was up next?
Well, the next match was a huge surprise for the studio audience. They had no idea that the Big Tex and Ron Bass had come back to the territory. They were, the Dothan fans didn't know it. He had not been there yet. He had already wrestled in Mobile, but he hadn't been to Dothan yet. But they all certainly remembered him, man. I can tell you that. Well enough to greet him with a nasty reception as soon as he came out of the dressing room. You'd have thought he'd been in the territory for 6 months, man. He was over. And that was always a good sign for a booker, man, especially one like I was, I'd never seen how Bass was used when he left the territory the last time. And, you know, I didn't know how well he was over in the Gulf Coast years before. So I had no idea how he had gotten over or how bad his heat was going to be hurt when he left the last time years ago. So I had not worked or even seen Ron Bass in 5 years. He worked for me a few shows in Knoxville in 1975, and it was great to see his reception and him to throw his opponent's body over his shoulder in this match, first one, and run across that ring and deliver that diving move he called the Texas Stampede. And wow, that left that poor jobber dragging himself off the mat after it was over. I'm telling you, Bass was a big boy, and when he put that move on you, you didn't jump up. You was lucky to get up.
Wow.
So after what I said earlier, Dave, about the possibility of losing both Golden and LeDuc, you know, I was extremely glad, man, to see this boy, right? You know, here's a guy that can fill one of those holes, hopefully, for sure.
Yeah.
So, you know, and besides being a great wrestler, Ron Bass was a tremendous guy, a great guy.
I never met him in person, but he sure was impressive in the ring. All right, how about the personality profile? Take us there.
Well, this one was even more crowded in profile than the last week before when Joe, Rob, and I were in a six-man tag last week. We were all on the profile. This time, the Georgia Jawjacker was added to the group. And we all watched the Wild Southeastern Championship Lumberjack from Mobile 4 days earlier, where the ring ended up full of wrestlers, man. There was no winner. I mean, it was wild. And it was going to happen again the following week. But next week, the ring was going to be full from the beginning of the match rather than everybody being in the ring by the end of that lumberjack match. And there were going to be eight of us in there, and hopefully, you know, this eight-man tag was going to end up with a winner at the end of it rather than having to be stopped. So the next TV match had the former Pittsburgh Steeler linebacker Charlie Cook in it. And on the upcoming card, Charlie was facing the fabulous Don Fargo again in a special challenge match. Like I mentioned a minute ago, they were in a 15-minute match the last time. This upcoming was going to be a 30-minute time limit match. So Don Fargo ended up at the set with Charlie. And he couldn't wait to tell a story of how he had demanded from Don Curtis another match with that football player, he called him, who was... You know, at that point in the ring wrestling, by the time this went on, and, you know, Fargo's had his opportunity. And, you know, and Fargo said, you know, I told Don Curtis, he says, no way a football player's ever going to beat me in a wrestling match. And he said he sure would win now that the match was going to be 30 minutes long. He said, I'll beat him in less than 30 minutes. There's no doubt about it. So Charlie Cook was in the ring and doing his thing, was looking like anything but just a football player, I can tell you that. Charlie Cook was a pretty darn good wrestler. And Charlie Platt relayed that fact to Fargo. And Charlie even added, when he made his comment, he said, what if you don't beat him and he beats you? Right? You know, you've run your mouth here a little bit, right? So Fargo got upset, man, and he swore that the football player, he said, that football player will never beat me. And then he promised Charlie, he said, if I don't beat the football player in less than 30 minutes, he says, I got another match in mind. And he goes, I'll be right back here next week if I don't win to tell everybody what that match is. So he got up and left the set about the time Charlie Cook pinned his opponent.
All right. How about the last TV match?
It was a rare eight-man tag match on TV, and it was a very good one at that. I mean, it had the Stomper in it, it had Big C, it had Jimmy Golden, it had Dr. Bill Irwin, and they had their hands full in this one because they were going to wrestle against Eddie Boulder, Roy Lee Welch, Ricky Fields, and Burrhead Jones. So the heels got the victory over Burrhead, and then they went to the set, and as the show was closing, they were screaming about eight-man tags being the kind of match that wrestlers got hurt in, and it wasn't going to be one of them.
All right, so, I mean, really good TV show, Stud. How about what happened four nights later as you take us to Mobile, Alabama.
Well, Eddie Boulder beat Bill Dromo. Randy Rose got the best of a very game Ricky Fields, who was a great little wrestler, man. Really, really enjoyed watching him wrestle. And his dad was always a great wrestler as well. Ron Bass made a great impression, man, on his first time back in Mobile in years. And he got himself a win over Roy Lee Welch. Don Fargo could not beat the football player in 30 minutes. And Charlie Cook, they ran out the time limit again. And so he was now going to ask Don Curtis for another match with the football player, but it wasn't going to be this match that he wanted to have now. Wasn't really about wrestling anymore. He wanted to have a brass knucks match the following week against Charlie Cook. And I guess Don Fargo really thought maybe, well, maybe I can't beat him in wrestling, but Mike can make him bleed so bad he'll quit. So, and then in the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship match, Norvell Austin stole the belt, basically. He got his foot on the ropes, and he got a pin. The referee didn't see his foot there. And for the second time, Norvell Austin had beaten Tony Charles for the United States Junior Championship. Then the eight-man tag match, it was a war from beginning to end. I mean, first referee got hurt in this match. The second one came down to the ring to replace him, and he was forced to disqualify both teams. I mean, these big tag matches, it's kind of like a battle royal, and once you get eight men in there, you can't hardly get them all out again. So the eight-man tag was going to be returning. In the type of match, the next one was going to have a no time limit, and it was going to be a no disqualification match. And we were going to have the next time a Texas death match, an eight-man Texas death match. That match's going to continue until one man couldn't answer the bell.
All right, so it sounds like the eight-man war was going to turn into an eight-man nightmare. How about the attendances in the three major cities for this one?
Montgomery held up. Stayed right where it was before. It had 4,000 a week before. It had 4,000 again. Dothan climbed a little bit from 4,300 up to 4,500 people. And Mobile had another sellout, second in a row at 5,600. That's all the expo would hold.
Wow. All right. Looks like we are going to have time enough for another learning tree question, Ron. This one comes from William Watson. He's in Charlotte, North Carolina. He says, I am a lifelong fan of Mid-Atlantic wrestling, but also a huge fan of your studcast. I have listened to hundreds of them, he says. My question is, what was your opinion of the four NWA world champions of the 1970s? Dory Funk Jr., Jack Briscoe, Terry Funk, and Harley Race. Did you wrestle them all? And which one did you prefer?
Wow, it's a great question. Mr. Watson, I think the last name was Watson. Mr. Watson, you grew up, man, in one of the best territories in the world. The Crockett family was another great example of wrestling fathers teaching their children well about the business. Big Jim Sr., Jim Crockett Sr., taught his boys the business from top to bottom, and they ran a great company over there in Mid-Atlantic territory. And also, thanks for being a Studcast fan. So, when I hear the names that you just mentioned, as the NWA World Champions of 1970, it's kind of like a who's who of wrestling, man, in that decade. I don't know how they could pick four wrestlers any better than those four guys to represent the national wrestling. I'm sure. And to your answer, your question, Mr. Watson, yes, I did. I wrestled all four of those guys for the title. And I would have had no chance to even give you any type of clear answer here or a picture here of how many times I wrestled each of these guys if there hadn't been for a couple of great friends that I had years and years ago that, after I retired, they put together a chart of all my matches from my career. And I've kept that chart. I still have it today. And it tells me everybody I wrestled on every night, most of the time, who won or lost. And you're asking me this is a pretty good task here to go back and tell you about the specifics of these four guys back in that time frame. But I'm going to do my best, man, and I'll try to remember as much as I can about this subject. So please bear with me. I'm going to try to answer your question as best I can. So let's start with Dory Funk Jr., who was the first of the four in that decade to be the champion. Jr. was basically a classic wrestler. He could go babyface or heel, and he was always in fantastic shape. I got my first NWA world title match ever with him. And I had only been in the ring for about 18 months when that happened. It was in 1972 in West Palm Beach, Florida. I wrestled him twice that year, both times in Florida. And about all I remember, man, William, I think your first name was, about all I remember, William, is him jarring my jaw teeth, man, with those vicious forearms to the face and the head that he was famous for. Wow, he had a wicked forearm, man. I think my first shot with Jack Briscoe was in Louisville, Kentucky, early 1975, probably. I remember that I had four championship matches in April and June of that year against Jack Briscoe. The first two of those matches with Jack was in Memphis, 2 weeks apart. And wow, these are memorable. This thing is really memorable because of different reason in a way. Because both of these matches, 2 weeks apart, sold out the Mid-South Coliseum. They sold out the building in record time. And we packed 11,300 fans in to both of those events. So, and I remember during that month of April of 1975, I was a Southern heavyweight champion. And in the four events that month, Memphis drew 43,700 fans in that building, a record that still stands today for that month. Four events in that building. So then there was one more match in Memphis after April with Jack. And the last title match I had with Jack in 1975 was in Knoxville. And it was memorable too because I was a heel at this point. And I naturally was cheating a little bit, from time to time. And I actually beat Jack in the middle of the ring. They counted him out, and they raised my hand, and I left the ring with the belt. So obviously, I didn't have it very long, just a few minutes after I got to the dressing room, but I did leave the ring in a world championship match as the champion. So in 1976, I turned babyface, and this next world title match that I'm pretty sure, I don't have the exact date, but I know it was in October of 1976. It was my only world championship match ever with Terry Funk. And it was another match in which I pinned the champion. At this point, I was a babyface, and I got my hand raised, and I was given the belt. The crowd was celebrating with me for about 30 seconds until the second referee came down to the ring and talked to the first one, and they got their heads together, and they changed the decision and took the belt back from me. And then Ronnie Garvin came down to the ring, and between him and Terry Funk, Ronnie Garvin jumped off the top rope on me several times after this match was over. And those two guys almost got mobbed by the crowd on the way to the dressing room, and I got sent to the hospital. So that's kind of why I remember that one.
Wow.
So then I guess I'm going to finish this with Harley Race, who after those first two title matches in 1973 and 74, I did wrestle Tarly between Jack Briscoe and You know, Harley was in there before Briscoe, and then he was in there basically after Terry. So in 1973 and 74, I'd had two matches with Harley for the NWA title. And in those matches, you know, Harley jumped off the top rope and hit me with a diving headbutt. Wow. So, you know, and he did it to me not just in the first one in Miami Beach, but in the second one, which was in St. Louis, with the same deal, with the same finish. Wow. And that was not an easy thing to take, too. So so after viewing the chart many times over the years and kind of adding things up, like, you know, you kind of want to do, you want to look back. And when you got this kind of a chart, man, you see everything there. World title matches, I know I wrestled for the NWA world title, Dory Funk, two times. I wrestled Jack Briscoe six times for the belt. I wrestled Terry Funk one time. I wrestled Hardy Race 12 times. And I think that's a total of 21 NWA World Championship matches and with these four champions. And all of the other titles title shots that I had after that were against Ric Flair, starting in 1981.
That's a great question, Mr. Watson. We appreciate that. I love the answer too. Hard to believe. 21 times, Ron, between 1972 and 1981, you wrestled for the NWA World Championship.
Yeah, that's correct, man. And, you know, and I was honored, Dave, I got to say, in every one of those matches for the opportunity to get in the ring with those guys.
I know I keep saying it, but again, this has been one of the best studcasts ever. It is filled with pure wrestling history from beginning to end, no doubt about it. All right, so where are we going to be riding on the next studcast?
Well, I know I said this was going to be the last hidden history lesson on my grandfather, Roy, but we're now into the 1940s of his history here, and I don't think I could forgive myself if I don't recognize him for his greatest accomplishment came in 1948. And that was when he became one of the founding fathers of the National Wrestling Alliance, which is the most powerful and successful organization of its kind in professional wrestling history. So in next studcast, we're going to finish up, Roy, with the NWA and kind of how that was all set up and kind of what my grandfather had to do with that organization and with that company. And then we're going to also be continuing with what was happening in Southeastern Wrestling in 1980. Jimmy's going to suffer a drastic and dramatic injury in this upcoming eight-man tag that looks so bad when it happened that all of us, every wrestler in that ring, thought that this was the end of Jimmy's wrestling career, that he would never wrestle again.
Wow.
And then hopefully, you know, we're going to have time for another great learning tree question, kind of like the one we had today, man.
And it was a good one. Listen, I'm glad to hear that we're going to be coming back for one more episode of your grandfather and learning about the NWA, how it started and what it accomplished. Every studcast now is so packed with history. I can't wait for Wednesdays each week when we record the next one, Stud. All right, folks, you know the deal. On Facebook, find Ron at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. Like and follow him there. Automatically become friends with a living legend. On Twitter, now known as X, he's at Ron Fuller Welch, and you can follow him there also. Check out the fantastic website, tnstud.com. This studcast is going to be there with every studcast ever done. Shop the stud store, where you can get 43 super studcasts, four different 8x10 photos, the thrilling Lion novel, Brutus, personally autographed to you, and t-shirts still on sale, only $15.99, all with absolutely free shipping. And by the way, subscribe now at YouTube Southeastern Rewind. Get the best in old school wrestling. You will find enough videos to stay occupied way more than a full weekend, probably several weekends. 416 videos, the last 121 studcasts, 52 stud stories, 113 short rides with the stud, and now 15 Ask the Stud question and answer shows. All this exclusively on YouTube Southeastern Rewind. It is the best deal in old school wrestling. All right, Ron, it's all up to you. Last words, anything?
Well, I'd just like to thank everybody, as usual, man, for their support. And please take care of yourselves and others out there, and may God bless us all.
For Ron Fuller in the Great Smoky Mountains, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This Studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud, LLC.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.